When he undertook the motions necessary to remove his evening clothes, he discovered that his muscles felt as if he were at the end of a long day of physical labor. His starched shirt was limp with sweat. There was neither thought nor feeling left in him, nothing but a sense that merged the remnants of both. The sense of congratulation upon the greatest victory he had ever demanded of himself. That Lillian had walked out of the hotel suite alive. Entering Reardon's office, Dr. Floyd Ferris wore the expression of a man so certain of the success of his quest that he could afford a benevolent smile. He spoke with a smooth, cheerful assurance. Reardon had the impression that it was the assurance of a card sharp who has spent a prodigious effort in memorizing every possible variation of the pattern and is now safe in the knowledge that every card in the deck is marked. "Well, Mr. Reardon," he said by way of greeting, "I didn't know that even a hardened hound of public functions and shaker of famous hands like myself could still get a thrill out of meeting an eminent man. But that's what I feel right now, believe it or not." "How do you do?" said Reardon. Dr. Ferris sat down and made a few remarks about the colors of the leaves in the month of October, as he had observed them by the roadside on his long drive from Washington, undertaken specifically for the purpose of meeting Mr. Reardon in person. Reardon said nothing. Dr. Ferris looked out the window and commented on the inspiring sight of the Reardon Mills, which he said were one of the most valuable productive enterprises in the country. "That is not what you thought of my product a year and a half ago," said Reardon. Dr. Ferris gave a brief frown, as if a dot of the pattern had slipped and almost cost him the game, then chuckled as if he had recaptured it. "That was a year and a half ago, Mr. Reardon," he said easily. "Times change, and people change with the times, the wise ones do. Wisdom lies in knowing when to remember and when to forget. Consistency is not a habit of mind, which it is wise to practice, or to expect of the human race." He then proceeded to discourse upon the foolishness of consistency in a world where nothing was absolute except the principle of compromise. He talked earnestly, but in a casual manner, as if both understood that this was not the main subject of their interview. Yet, oddly, he spoke not in the tone of a foreword, but in the tone of a postscript, as if the main subject had been settled long ago. Reardon waited for the first, "Don't you think so?" and answered, "Please state the urgent matter for which you requested this appointment." Dr. Ferris looked astonished and blank for a moment, then said brightly, as if remembering an unimportant subject which could be disposed of without effort, "Oh, that? That was in regard to the dates of delivery of Reardon metal to the State Science Institute. We should like to have 5,000 tons by the 1st of December, and then we'll be quite agreeable to waiting for the balance of the order until after the 1st of the year. Reardon sat looking at him silently for a long time. Each passing moment had the effect of making the gay intonations of Dr. Ferris's voice, still hanging in the air of the room, seem more foolish. When Dr. Ferris had begun to dread that he would not answer at all, Reardon answered, "Hasn't the traffic cop with the leather leggings whom you sent here given you a report on his conversation with me?" "Why, yes, Mr. Reardon, but what else do you want to hear?" "But that was 5 months ago, Mr. Reardon. A certain event has taken place since, which makes me quite sure that you have changed your mind, and that you will make no trouble for us at all, just as we will make no trouble for you." "What event?" "An event of which you have far greater knowledge than I." "But you see, I do have knowledge of it, even though you would much prefer me to have none." "What event?" "Since it is your secret, Mr. Reardon, why not let it remain a secret? Who doesn't have secrets nowadays? For instance, Project X is a secret. You realize, of course, that we could obtain your metal simply by having it purchased in smaller quantities by various government offices, who would then transfer it to us, and you would not be able to prevent it. But this would necessitate our letting a lot of lousy bureaucrats." Dr. Ferris smiled with disarming frankness. "Oh, yes, we are as unpopular with one another as we are with you private citizens. It would necessitate our letting a lot of other bureaucrats in on the secret of Project X, which would be highly undesirable at this time. And so would any newspaper publicity about the project, if we put you on trial for refusal to comply with a government order. but if you had to stand trial on another, much more serious charge, where Project X and the State Science Institute were not involved, and where you could not raise any issue of principle or arouse any public sympathy, why, that would not inconvenience us at all, but it would cost you more than you would care to contemplate. Therefore, the only practical thing for you to do is to help us keep our secret, and get us to help you keep yours. And, as I'm sure you realize, we are fully able to keep any of the bureaucrats safely off your trail for as long as we wish. What event, what secret, and what trail? Oh, come, Mr. Reardon, don't be childish. The 4,000 tons of Reardon metal, which you delivered to Ken Daniger, of course, said Dr. Ferris lightly. Reardon did not answer. Issues of principle are such a nuisance, said Dr. Ferris, smiling, and such a waste of time for all concerned. Now, would you care to be a martyr for an issue of principle, only in circumstances where nobody will know that that's what you are, nobody but you and me, where you won't get a chance to breathe a word about the issue or the principle, where you won't be a hero, the creator of a spectacular new metal, making a stand against enemies whose actions might appear somewhat shabby in the eyes of the public, where you won't be a hero, but a common criminal, a greedy industrialist who's cheated the law for a plain motive of profit, a racketeer of the black market who's broken the national regulations designed to protect the public welfare. A hero without glory and without public will accomplish no more than about half a column of newsprint somewhere on page 5. Now, would you still care to be that kind of martyr? Because that's just what the issue amounts to now. Either you let us have the medal, or you go to jail for 10 years, and take your friend Daniger along, too. As a biologist, Dr. Ferris had always been fascinated by the theory that animals had the capacity to smell fear. He had tried to develop a similar capacity in himself. Watching Reardon, he concluded that the man had long since decided to give in, because he caught no trace of any fear. "Who was your informer?" asked Reardon. "One of your friends, Mr. Reardon. The owner of a copper mine in Arizona who reported to us that you had purchased an extra amount of copper last month, above the regular tonnage required for the monthly quota of Reardon metal which the law permits you to produce. Copper is one of the ingredients of Reardon metal, isn't it? That was all the information we needed. The rest was easy to trace. You mustn't blame that mine owner too much. The copper producers, as you know, are being squeezed so badly right now that the man had to offer something of value in order to obtain a favor, an emergency need ruling which suspended a few of the directives in his case and gave him a little breathing spell. The person to whom he traded his information knew where it would have its highest value, so he traded it to me in return for certain favors he needed. So all the necessary evidence, as well as the next 10 years of your life, are now in my possession. And I'm offering you a trade. I'm sure you won't object, since trade is your specialty. The form may be a little different from what it was in your youth, but you're a smart trader. You've always known how to take advantage of changing conditions. And these are the conditions of our day. So it should not be difficult for you to see where your interests lie, and to act accordingly. Reardon said calmly, "In my youth, this was called blackmail." Dr. Ferris grinned. "That's what it is, Mr. Reardon. We've entered a much more realistic age." But there was a peculiar difference, thought Reardon, between the manner of a plain blackmailer and that of Dr. Ferris. A blackmailer would show signs of gloating over his victim's sin and of acknowledging its evil. He would suggest a threat to the victim and a sense of danger to them both. Dr. Ferris conveyed none of it. His manner was that of dealing with the normal and the natural. It suggested a sense of safety. It held no tone of condemnation, but a hint of comradeship, a comradeship based, for both of them, on self-contempt. The sudden feeling that made Reardon lean forward in a posture of eager attentiveness was the feeling that he was about to discover another step along his half-glimpsed trail. Seeing Reardon's look of interest, Dr. Ferris smiled and congratulated himself on having caught the right key. The game was clear to him now. The markings of the pattern were falling in the right order. Some men, thought Dr. Ferris, would do anything so long as it was left unnamed. But this man wanted frankness. This was the tough realist he had expected to find. "You're a practical man, Mr. Reardon," said Dr. Ferris amiably. "I can't understand why you should want to stay behind the times. Why don't you adjust yourself and play it right? You're smarter than most of them. You're a valuable person. We've wanted you for a long time. And when I heard that you were trying to string along with Jim Taggart, I knew you could be had. Don't bother with Jim Taggart. He's nothing. He's just flea bait. Get into the big game. We can use you, and you can use us. Want us to step on Orrin Boyle for you? He's given you an awful beating. Want us to trim him down a little? It can be done. Or want us to keep Ken Daniger in line? Look how impractical you've been about that. I know why you sold him the medal. It's because you need him to get coal from. So you take a chance on going to jail and paying huge fines just to keep on the good side of Ken Daniger. Do you call that good business? Now make a deal with us, and just let Mr. Daniger understand that if he doesn't toe the line, he'll go to jail, but you won't, because you've got friends he hasn't got. And you'll never have to worry about your coal supply from then on. Now that's the modern way of doing business. Ask yourself which way is more practical, and whatever anyone's said about you, nobody's ever denied that you're a great businessman and a hard-headed realist." "That's what I am," said Reardon. "That's what I thought," said Dr. Ferris. "You rose to riches in an age when most men were going bankrupt. You've always managed to blast obstacles, to keep your mills going, and to make money. That's your reputation. So you wouldn't want to be impractical now, would you? What for? What do you care so long as you make money? Leave the theories to people like Bertram Scudder, and the ideals to people like Balfe Eubank. And be yourself. Come down to earth. You're not the man who'd let sentiment interfere with business."
"No," said Reardon slowly. "I wouldn't. Not any kind of sentiment."
Dr. Ferris smiled.
"Don't you suppose we knew it?" he said, his tone suggesting that he was letting his patent leather hair down to impress a fellow criminal by a display of superior cunning. "We've waited a long time to get something on you. You honest men are such a problem and such a headache. But we knew you'd slip sooner or later, and this is just what we wanted. You seem to be pleased about it. Don't I have good reason to be? But after all, I did break one of your laws. Well, what do you think they're for?"
Dr. Ferris did not notice the sudden look on Reardon's face, the look of a man hit by the first vision of that which he had sought to see. Dr. Ferris was past the stage of seeing. He was intent upon delivering the last blows to an animal caught in a trap.
"Did you really think that we want those laws to be observed?" said Dr. Ferris.
"We want them broken. You'd better get it straight that it's not a bunch of Boy Scouts you're up against. Then you'll know that this is not the age for beautiful gestures. We're after power, and we mean it. You fellows were pikers, but we know the real trick, and you'd better get wise to it. There's no way to rule innocent men. The only power any government has is the power to crack down on criminals. Well, when there aren't enough criminals, one makes them. One declares so many things to be a crime that it becomes impossible for men to live without breaking laws. Who wants a nation of law-abiding citizens? What's there in that for anyone? But just pass the kind of laws that can neither be observed nor enforced nor objectively interpreted, and you create a nation of lawbreakers. And then you cash in on guilt. Now that's the system, Mr. Reardon. That's the game. And once you understand it, you'll be much easier to deal with." Watching Dr. Ferris watch him, Reardon saw the sudden twitch of anxiety, the look that precedes panic, as if a clean card had fallen on the table from a deck Dr. Ferris had never seen before. What Dr. Ferris was seeing in Reardon's face was the look of luminous serenity that comes from the sudden answer to an old dark problem, a look of relaxation and eagerness together. There was a youthful clarity in Reardon's eyes, and the faintest touch of contempt in the line of his mouth. Whatever this meant, and Dr. Ferris could not decipher it, he was certain of one thing. The face held no sign of guilt.
"There's a flaw in your system, Dr. Ferris," Reardon said quietly, almost lightly. "A practical flaw which you will discover when you put me on trial for selling 4,000 tons of Reardon metal to Ken Daniger."
It took 20 seconds.
Reardon could feel them moving past slowly, at the end of which Dr. Ferris became convinced that he had heard Reardon's final decision.
"Do you think we're bluffing?"
snapped Dr. Ferris. His voice suddenly had the quality of the animals he had spent so much time studying. It sounded as if he were baring his teeth.
"I don't know," said Reardon. "I don't care one way or the other." "Are you going to be as impractical as that?"
"The evaluation of an action as practical, Dr. Ferris, depends on what it is that one wishes to practice.
Haven't you always placed your self-interest above all else?"
"That is what I'm doing right now."
"If you think we'll let you get away with a..."
"You will now please get out of here."
"Whom do you think you're fooling?"
Dr. Ferris's voice had ridden close to the edge of a scream.
"The day of the barons of industry is done. You've got the goods, but we've got the goods on you. And you're going to play it our way, or you'll..."
Reardon had pressed a button. Miss Ives entered the office. "Dr. Ferris has become confused and has lost his way, Miss Ives," said Reardon. "Will you escort him out, please?" He turned to Ferris. "Miss Ives is a woman. She weighs about 100 pounds, and she has no practical qualifications at all, only a superlative intellectual efficiency. She would never do for a bouncer in a saloon, only in an impractical place, such as a factory." Miss Ives looked as if she was performing a duty of no greater emotional significance than taking dictation about a list of shipping invoices. Standing straight in a disciplined manner of icy formality, she held the door open, let Dr. Ferris cross the room, then walked out first. Dr. Ferris followed. She came back a few minutes later, laughing in uncontrollable exultation.
"Mr. Reardon?"
she asked, laughing at her fear for him, at their danger, at everything but the triumph of the moment.
"What is it you're doing?"
He sat in a pose he had never permitted himself before, a pose he had resented as the most vulgar symbol of the businessman. He sat leaning back in his chair with his feet on his desk, and it seemed to her that the posture had an air of peculiar nobility, that it was not the pose of a stuffy executive, but of a young crusader.
"I think I'm discovering a new continent, Gwen," he answered cheerfully.
"A continent that should have been discovered along with America, but wasn't. I have to speak of it to you," said Eddie Willers, looking at the worker across the table. "I don't know why it helps me, but it does. Just to know that you're hearing me." It was late, and the lights of the underground cafeteria were low, but Eddie Willers could see the worker's eyes looking at him intently. "I feel as if there's no people and no human language left," said Eddie Willers. "I feel that if I were to scream in the middle of the streets, there would be no one to hear it." "No, that's not quite what I feel. It's this. I feel that someone is screaming in the middle of the streets, but people are passing by and no sound can reach them. And it's not Hank Reardon or Ken Daniger or I who's screaming. And yet it seems as if it's all three of us. Don't you see that somebody should have risen to defend them, but nobody has or will? Reardon and Daniger were indicted this morning for an illegal sale of Reardon metal. They'll go on trial next month. I was there in the courtroom in Philadelphia when they read the indictment. Reardon was very calm. I kept feeling that he was smiling, but he wasn't. Daniger was worse than calm. He didn't say a word. He just stood there as if the room were empty. The newspapers are saying that both of them should be thrown in jail." "No. No, I'm not shaking. I'm all right. I'll be all right in a moment. That's why I haven't said a word to her. I was afraid I'd explode, and I didn't want to make it harder for her. I know how she feels." "Oh, yes, she spoke to me about it. And she didn't shake, but it was worse. You know the kind of rigidity when a person acts as if she didn't feel anything at all, and... Listen, did I ever tell you that I like you? I like you very much. For the way you look right now. You hear us. You understand."
"What did she say?"
"It was strange. It's not Hank Reardon that she's afraid for. It's Ken Daniger. She said that Reardon will have the strength to take it, but Daniger won't. Not that he'll lack the strength, but he'll refuse to take it. She feels certain that Ken Daniger will be the next one to go, to go like Ellis Wyatt and all those others, to give up and vanish.
Why?
Well, she thinks that there's something like a shift of stress involved, economic and personal stress. As soon as all the weight of the moment shifts to the shoulders of some one man, he's the one who vanishes, like a pillar slashed off. A year ago, nothing worse could have happened to the country than to lose Ellis Wyatt. He's the one we lost. Since then, she says, it's been as if the center of gravity were swinging wildly, like in a sinking cargo ship out of control, shifting from industry to industry, from man to man. When we lose one, another becomes that much more desperately needed, and he's the one we lose next.
Well, what could be a greater disaster now than to have the country's coal supply left in the hands of men like Boyle or Larkin? And there's no one left in the coal industry who amounts to much except Ken Daniger. So she says that she feels almost as if he's a marked man, as if he's hit by a spotlight right now, waiting to be cut down.
What are you laughing at? It might sound preposterous, but I think it's true.
What?
Oh, yes, you bet she's a smart woman.
And then there's another thing involved, she says. A man has to come to a certain mental stage, not anger or despair, but something much, much more than both, before he can be cut down. She can't tell what it is, but she knew long before the fire that Ellis Wyatt had reached that stage, and something would happen to him. When she saw Ken Daniger in the courtroom today, she said that he was ready for the destroyer. Yes, that's the word she used. He was ready for the destroyer. You see, she doesn't think it's happening by chance or accident. She thinks there's a system behind it, an intention, a man. There's a destroyer loose in the country who's cutting down the buttresses one after another to let the structure collapse upon our heads. Some ruthless creature moved by some inconceivable purpose. She says that she won't let him get Ken Daniger. She keeps repeating that she must stop Daniger. She wants to speak to him, to beg, to plead, to revive whatever it is that he's losing, to arm him against the destroyer before the destroyer comes. She's desperately anxious to reach Daniger first. He has refused to see anyone. He's gone back to Pittsburgh, to his mines. But she got him on the phone late today, and she's made an appointment to see him tomorrow afternoon. Yes, she'll go to Pittsburgh tomorrow. Yes, she's afraid for Daniger, terribly afraid.
No, she knows nothing about the destroyer. She has no clue to his identity, no evidence of his existence except the trail of destruction. But she feels certain that he exists.
No, she cannot guess his purpose. She says that nothing on earth could justify him. There are times when she feels that she'd like to find him more than any other man in the world, more than the inventor of the motor. She says that if she found the destroyer, she'd shoot him on sight. She'd be willing to give her life if she could take his first and by her own hand.
Because he's the most evil creature that's ever existed, the man who's draining the brains of the world.
I guess it's getting to be too much for her at times, even for her. I don't think she allows herself to know how tired she is. The other morning I came to work very early, and I found her asleep on the couch in her office with the light still burning on her desk. She'd been there all night. I just stood and looked at her. I wouldn't have awakened her if the whole goddamn railroad collapsed.
When she was asleep?
Well, she looked like a young girl.
She looked as if she felt certain that she would awaken in a world where no one would harm her, as if she had nothing to hide or to fear. That's what was terrible, that guiltless purity of her face, with her body twisted by exhaustion, still lying there as she had collapsed. She looked...
Say, why should you ask me what she looks like when she's asleep?
Yes, you're right. Why do I talk about it? I shouldn't. I don't know what made me think of it. Don't pay any attention to me. I'll be all right tomorrow. I guess it's just that I'm sort of shell-shocked by that courtroom. I keep thinking if men like Reardon and Daniger are to be sent to jail, then what kind of world are we working in, and what for? Isn't there any justice left on earth? I was foolish enough to say that to a reporter when we were leaving the courtroom, and he just laughed and said, "Who is John Galt?" Tell me, what's happening to us? Isn't there a single man of justice left? Isn't there anyone to defend them? Oh, do you hear me? Isn't there anyone to defend them?
Mr. Daniger will be free in a moment, Miss Taggart. He has a visitor in his office. Will you excuse it, please? Said the secretary.
Through the 2 hours of her flight to Pittsburgh, Dagny had been tensely unable to justify her anxiety or to dismiss it. There was no reason to count minutes, yet she had felt a blind desire to hurry. The anxiety vanished when she entered the anteroom of Ken Daniger's office. She had reached him. Nothing had happened to prevent it. She felt safety, confidence, and an enormous sense of relief. The words of the secretary demolished it. "You're becoming a coward," thought Dagny, feeling a causeless jolt of dread at the words, out of all proportion to their meaning. "I am so sorry, Miss Taggart," she heard the secretary's respectful, solicitous voice, and realized that she had stood there without answering. "Mr. Daniger will be with you in just a moment. Won't you sit down?" The voice conveyed an anxious concern over the impropriety of keeping her waiting. Dagny smiled. "Oh, that's quite all right." She sat down in a wooden armchair facing the secretary's railing. She reached for a cigarette and stopped, wondering whether she would have time to finish it, hoping that she would not, then lighted it brusquely. It was an old-fashioned frame building, this headquarters of the great Daniger Coal Company. Somewhere in the hills beyond the window were the pits where Ken Daniger had once worked as a miner. He had never moved his office away from the coal fields. She could see the mine entrances cut into the hillsides, small frames of metal girders that led to an immense underground kingdom. They seemed precariously modest, lost in the violent orange and red of the hills. Under a harsh blue sky, in the sunlight of late October, the sea of leaves looked like a sea of fire, like waves rolling to swallow the fragile posts of the mine doorways. She shuddered and looked away. She thought of the flaming leaves spread over the hills of Wisconsin, on the road to Starnesville. She noticed that there was only a stub left of the cigarette between her fingers. She lighted another. When she glanced at the clock on the wall of the anteroom, she caught the secretary glancing at it at the same time. Her appointment was for 3 o'clock. The white dial said 3:12. "Please forgive it, Miss Taggart," said the secretary. "Mr. Daniger will be through any moment now. Mr. Daniger is extremely punctual about his appointments. Please believe me that this is unprecedented." "I know it." She knew that Ken Daniger was as rigidly exact about his schedule as a railroad timetable, and that he had been known to cancel an interview if a caller permitted himself to arrive 5 minutes late. The secretary was an elderly spinster with a forbidding manner, a manner of even-toned courtesy impervious to any shock, just as her spotless white blouse was impervious to an atmosphere filled with coal dust. Dagny thought it strange that a hardened, well-trained woman of this type should appear to be nervous. She volunteered no conversation. She sat still, bent over some pages of paper on her desk. Half of Dagny's cigarette had gone in smoke, while the woman still sat looking at the same page. When she raised her head to glance at the clock, the dial said 3:30. "I know that this is inexcusable, Miss Taggart." The note of apprehension was obvious in her voice now. "I am unable to understand it." "Would you mind telling Mr. Daniger that I'm here?"
"I can't."
It was almost a cry. She saw Dagny's astonished glance and felt obliged to explain. "Mr. Daniger called me on the interoffice communicator and told me that he was not to be interrupted under any circumstances or for any reason whatever."
"When did he do that?"
The moment's pause was like a small air cushion for the answer.
2 hours ago."
Dagny looked at the closed door of Daniger's office. She could hear the sound of a voice beyond the door, but so faintly that she could not tell whether it was the voice of one man or the conversation of two. She could not distinguish the words or the emotional quality of the tone. It was only a low, even progression of sounds that seemed normal and did not convey the pitch of raised voices. "How long has Mr. Daniger been in conference?" she asked.
"Since 1 o'clock," said the secretary grimly, then added in apology, "It was an unscheduled caller, or Mr. Daniger would never have permitted this to happen.